It's a real-life poetic drama.
When we say it's poetic, we mean that it is written in Hebrew poetry. Because it's written in Hebrew poetry, it's sometimes hard to interpret, and it's very difficult to know who is speaking at any given moment. So you have to look for clues in the story or in the paragraph to see who is speaking. Okay? It's a poetic drama about a young farm girl, shepherd girl, who's in love, and somehow she has been brought into Solomon's apartments with his harem. And Solomon is the king of Israel, and he has too many wives. In fact, in the book we're told he had some 60 wives, about 80 concubines, and then a group called the virgins of the harem. Well, we finished this section last week. We finished the second paragraph, or the second scene of the drama. And it is a procession of Solomon in which he is bringing a new bride into his harem. Remember, they had the bridal chair, and they had this sort of elite chair that they carried. And he had just taken a new bride. Now we're ready for the next paragraph, which begins in chapter 4, and it's a long scene, okay? It's the major scene of the whole book. It's in Solomon's palace in Jerusalem, okay? And it's going to open up with Solomon making a pitch, or he is analyzing the physical anatomy of the Shulamite woman, whom we said was a very, very beautiful gal. So let's read verse 1 through maybe just a couple verses. Solomon now is analyzing the Shulamite woman. And he says, "Behold, you are fair, my love. Behold, you are fair. You have dove's eyes within thy locks," which meant that her black hair sort of come down around her eyes. "Thy hair is like as a flock of goats that appear from Mount Gilead. Your teeth are like a flock of sheep that are even shorn." What's that mean? Sheep that are shorn. No? Clipped. Okay, now, you ever see a sheep that are clipped? They look, what do they look like?
Weird.
Smooth, yeah, they look smooth, right. White, yeah, right. They look weird. Yeah. They do look weird. Yeah, they look even. You know, when they're not clipped, they can be, you can have a lot of wool hanging on the sides and a little bit on the back. But when they clip them, the hair is even all over, see? So he says, your teeth are like that. And then it says, which just came up from the washing. In other words, these sheep had just come through like a pond or a clear stream, whereof every one bear twins. And none is barren among them, which means what?
Yeah,
she doesn't have any black spots or teeth missing, empty spots. Okay. Your lips are like a thread of scarlet. What's that mean? Your rips are like a thread of scarlet. What'd you say? Yeah, they're very, very red. If you ever notice a girl who's been trained, just before a person's going to take your picture, if you'll bite her lips a little, and then she'll wet them. Why? It makes them look red. Yeah, it makes them look alive, see? Okay. Yeah. So Solomon's analyzing this girl. "Thy temples are like a piece of pomegranate within thy locks. Thy neck is like a tower of David built for an armory." That sounds like a giraffe, but really, that isn't what he's saying. It's really, look what he says. "Where in there hang thousands of bucklers. Thy two breasts are like two young roes that are twins and feed among the lilies." Okay? Okay, Solomon has just come into the city with a new bride. And we're not told how much time takes place, but in the very next scene, he's trying to make a pitch for the Shulamite woman. Now, we've repeated this, and you know this, but for the new ones that are here, there's a few new ones. She is resisting Solomon because she is engaged to a young shepherd. Solomon's very, very wealthy, has these luxurious places to live, drives a new Mercedes, has all the luxuries, but she has no interest in him whatsoever. He is simply interested in her. And so he describes her physically in this passage. Okay? Lo, you are fair, he says. Now, I want to give a principle here. It's appropriate. It doesn't relate to Solomon, but it relates to you. Okay? What was the last principle we had? 15? Principle 16. Okay, principle number 16. Sounds like a noisy fan. That's what it is. Now look. You're a right man. You're a right man. Or a right woman. This is something you really can take confidence in. Will be beautiful to you. Your right man or right woman will be beautiful to you. Now underline the to you. Okay. In other words, if you really identify with a girl, she may not have Miss America standards. In other words, she might have the wrong right figures, but in the wrong order. She might be a 24, 36, 38. But she'll be beautiful to you. See? Do you ever, maybe you've experienced this in your schools, I don't know, or in your lifetime, but maybe there's a guy and a girl and they go together. They see each other all the time. And you say, I don't see what she sees in him. Well, of course you don't see what she sees in him. She sees something in him that you don't see. Or you say, I don't know why that guy goes with a girl. I don't see what he sees in her. Of course not. But if they are by divine design for each other, they will identify. See, they will like each other, regardless of the appearance. He may look like he's been kicked in the face by a horse, or maybe bent out of shape, but to God's woman that's for him, she is going to look nice, and he is going to look nice. Okay? Okay, now that's then, there's another point then that goes with that, or there's another idea, that sort of a corollary that goes with that. It is this. If you are interested in somebody, if you are interested in somebody, and they are not, or maybe I shouldn't say they, he, she is not beautiful to you, that person is not your right man or right woman. In other words, there'll be an attractiveness there. Whether other people see the attractiveness is not the important thing. It's the fact that you see it. Okay? Now we said the problem, one of the problems with Solomon is that he is so caught up with the physical aspects of a woman that his mind is blown, his soul is blown. And a man that gets caught up in physical and sexual lust like he is in, he just has to have one woman after another, he keeps having to add somebody to his harem, he won't even know how to talk to a woman. He'll lose his capacity to talk to a woman. Every time Solomon looks or makes a statement about the Shulamite woman, he always says something about her physical aspects. Now he's going to do the same thing in the seventh chapter. He did it in chapter 1. He's doing it here in chapter 4. And he will do it again in chapter 7. He'll look at her and he'll describe her physical aspects. Here he starts with her head and he works down to her breasts. In chapter 7, he starts with her feet and he works up to her head. Let's just jot down, let's put another principle down and then we'll illustrate it. This is principle number 17. Solomon was overly attracted to the physical. Okay? His soul capacity to love, his soul capacity, and remember, it is in your soul that you really love a person and have identity with them. His soul capacity to love is gone. Hence, the sex-physical takes over, or has taken over. His mind. Hey, now let's back up for a second, okay? Do you think that God makes something beautiful and then asks you not to look at it? Huh? No. You ought to be able to evaluate certain relative beauty, a relative handsomeness. You're all capable of that. Now, God didn't make the Shulamite woman beautiful and then ask all men don't look at her. He doesn't do that. Everybody knows a curved line is prettier than a straight line, see? And so God makes a woman curvy and he makes a man appreciate that, see? So there's nothing wrong with appreciating it. It's just when a man thinks of that all the time, then he doesn't have capacity to really express himself properly in his soul. And this is Solomon. Let's just go through a couple things that he says. Look, he starts off with her eyes. Thou hast dove's eyes within thy locks. Here is what the Shulamite woman looked like. Shulamite description, or Shulamite's description, by Solomon, see? First of all, he starts off with her eyes. Okay? Now what he's saying is that her eyes were very large and wide apart. Now, woman's eyes, or well, not just a woman's eyes, but everybody's eyes are the windows of their soul. And her eyes didn't look like road maps with interstate highways running through them in red and blue veins showing in her eyes. She had very clear white eyes, very attractive. Probably didn't even have to have any eyeshadow on. She didn't look like she just came out of a beauty parlor. She probably had blue eyes because she was Jewish. Okay? Now she had her hair is raven black. Raven black, like the black goats of that are on Gilead. Raven black, like Mount Gilead goats. Fleecy like goats, see? So she had this fluffy hair. She didn't even have Farrah Fawcett's hair dryer or hair doer. It was just natural. Okay? Now, you know, teeth in the ancient world were not, well, they didn't have orthodontry like we had today. You know, they didn't have braces and stuff. You heard about the two teenagers that had braces and they kissed and the braces got stuck? Teeth were a pro. They didn't have any crest, fluoride, or drill presses. And so a beautiful doll might come along, see, and you say hello to her, and she smiles, and there are no teeth in the front. I mean, that would be common. That would be a very common thing. We take for granted what we have now, you see, in terms of all this work on our teeth and that. But they didn't have it in the ancient world. So what they would do, they would use twigs, they would use sticks, they would have a stick that was sort of curved and not too sharp, and they would clean their teeth with a stick. Or with apples, they'd eat a lot of apples. Or they'd take lemons and clean their teeth, see? So he describes her teeth. He says, now her teeth are perfect. Thy teeth are like a flock of sheep that are even shorn. In other words, she didn't have problems with crooked teeth. In other words, one wasn't longer than the other. Nowadays, with all the orthodontry we have, you know, they can do fantastic things with young people's teeth. When I was young, they didn't have that then. I mean, you know, my mouth looks like a silver mine. It has so many fillings in it. Her, she didn't have any fillings. They're even, they're shorn, they're clean, which came up from the washing. Wherein everyone bears twins. That is, they matched when she bit, you know. Now, when I bite, I have an overhang. I don't know how good mine, they probably don't match too good, I don't know. But hers matched. In other words, she had a beautiful mouth structure, see? In other words, these were perfectly formed, matched, and above all, they were clean. Did you ever kiss a girl and smell a camel at the same time? That used to be our joke when girls smoked and had camel cigarettes. Her mouth was clean, and she apparently made great effort to keep herself attractive that way. Okay? Well, I think it's super. None is barren. There were none missing, see? None missing. Hey, you know, just parenthetically, you ought to really take care of your teeth because it is a part of your anatomy that can be so attractive in terms of identity. You know, you smile and you ought to have a clean mouth. You may not have the best matched teeth, but they ought to at least be clean. And while you're young, you ought to develop a habit of, you know, using dental floss and keeping your mouth clean. Particularly when you go to kiss somebody, it really, really makes it much more easy on them if you have clean teeth. Is that right, Ron? What do you mean you don't know? Don't you agree? Sure. Okay. Okay, next he goes to her lips. Now, her lips are very shapely. He says, your lips are like a thread of scarlet. And then he says, thy speech... Now, finally, he gets to something. He says, your speech is comely. In other words, she had a nice voice. You always want to marry a woman with a nice voice because you can never shut her up. She isn't nice looking. You can put a sack over her head, but you can't shut her up. Okay? So what he's talking about is that they were very red and thin-lined. Oh, this gal was a doll. She was a knockout. Okay? Excellent diction, beautiful sonnets. She had a good Hebrew accent. Okay? Thy temples are like a piece of pomegranate within thy locks. That's her cheeks, see? So now he describes her cheeks, and they are kind of like a peach, sort of peach color. Okay? Okay. There's a symmetry here. A good symmetry with sort of a peach color. Now you get that? See, here is this black-haired, blue-eyed, very clear eyes, even cheekbones. She hadn't been all busted up by somebody beating on her. Nice teeth. Now he gets to her neck. Okay. Now the way it's described here, it sounds like she's a giraffe, but not really. By the way, her pink, she had sort of a nice color about her. Probably because she was an outdoor type, see? She didn't look like a fugitive from a blood bank. She didn't look like the chalk cliffs down in Nathrop, down in the Rockies. She had good color about her. Okay? Then her neck. Thy neck is like the Tower of David, builded for an armory. Now, he's not describing a giraffe. What he's describing is that she had a noble carriage. See? A noble carriage about herself. She was poised. Even though she was a farm girl. She was a shepherdess. But see, she had presence about her. You know? And the reason that she had presence about her is that she had a good self-image. See, if you have a bad self-image, then you tend to manifest it even in your physical characteristics, like you. See? If you have a good, healthy self-image, you will have a certain physical presence about you that you walk with a good, healthy pride. You stand up straight, see? That's what he's describing, her noble carriage. Okay? So what he's saying is, your neck is fit for jewelry from the warriors, wherein there hang thousands of bucklers. In other words, the warriors would be proud to be identified with you. Your dignity and posture are magnificent. Here is a woman that's a farm girl, but she's no slouch, you see. Okay, now he gets to her breasts. Okay? Her breasts. Okay? Verse 5. Thy two breasts are like two young roes that are twins, which feed among the lilies. What he's saying is she is beautifully proportioned with the rest of her body. Now let me say a word about the importance of this aspect and Solomon's attitude, not particularly Solomon's attitude, but how important this was in the ancient world. He says that her breasts are like two young roes that are twins. The word roes there is either gazelles or young deer. So what he means is there is a quality of youthful freshness. That's the idea. Like you would expect from a young gazelle or a young deer. Now here's one of the points of this. Look, in the ancient world, in the world in which Solomon lived, and the Shulamite woman, they didn't have a Bureau of Vital Statistics so that when you were born, they took your footprint and put it on a birth certificate, put your name on there, put your mother and dad's name on there, put your address or the address of your parents, and kept the record of your physical age. It was possible in the time of Solomon that you would meet a young person and they wouldn't know how old they were. They wouldn't know what their physical age was. One of the barometers of, barometer is a measuring, one of the measuring sticks of marital age was the development, see, of the female breast. If that part of the physical anatomy of a woman was not developed, then her marital status was in question. See? She wouldn't be considered a candidate for marriage. Okay? Okay. Okay, so you get to this point, and Solomon, all he can think about is this physique of this girl, see? He is a wealthy, fat-headed, egocentric boor, a man whose soul has been overwhelmed by sensuousness. Solomon thinks he is God's gift to womankind. He's done comparative anatomy on the Shulamite woman. In other words, he's compared her with all the other women. And he really wants her. But again, she is totally... She can't identify with this guy. So in verse 6, the Shulamite woman speaks, and she says, and this is a repeated statement that she has throughout the book, "Until the day breaks and the shadows flee away, I will get me to the mountain of myrrh and to the hill of frank incense." Now what she means by that is, until this darkness ceases and daylight comes, what she means is that this is depressing to her. And until that lifts, till her shepherd lover comes and removes her from the darkness, she is going to dwell with him in her mind in the mountain of myrrh and in the hill of frank incense. In other words, she pays no attention whatsoever to Solomon. She's not interested in his pitch or anything he has to offer. Okay, now what do you think her shepherd lover was thinking all this time? I mean, he's separated from her. He's concerned about her. What do you expect that he was thinking? Suppose he knew she was down in Solomon's palace, knowing Solomon and knowing how beautiful she was. Okay? Well, there's a principle here. See, she is protected in her mentality. So let's get another principle down. Principle number, what is this? 18? 18, okay. If you have met your right man, we'll abbreviate now, or a right woman, and you are separated, in courtship. That's what's happened here with her and the guy she really loved, the guy she's engaged to. If you have met your right man or right woman and you are separated in courtship, you will not have to worry. About one another being true. While apart. Okay? If you have a proper relationship. Now, what I'm talking about right men, what I'm talking about here is if you are scripturally oriented. Let's put it that way. If you are scripturally oriented. If you meet a girl and you think she's your, or let's apply it to the guys. If you meet a girl and you say you go in the service or you go off to college and she sends you a Dear John, well, thank the Lord for it. I mean, the fact that she wouldn't stay true to you is indicative that you don't have a right relationship or that wasn't your right woman. Okay? Here is a gal that's separated and she is under the most tempting circumstances in terms of physical appeal. She rejects it. She turns it down. Okay? Okay, now, right about this point, something dramatic happens in this story. We're not told all the detail. We're not given even much of the circumstances that bring it about. Perhaps it happened after this affair, this thing with Solomon. Perhaps she walked to the window. In the Amplified Bible, it says that she walked to the window and she saw her shepherd lover outside looking through the lattice. All we know is that her shepherd lover shows up. Now let me show you how we know. Will you look at verse 8? Verse 8 says, "Come with me from Lebanon, my spouse." Now that word spouse in Hebrew is a feminine and it means my promised bride. Okay? So he calls her. The person that's speaking to her is engaged to her. And he calls her this in verse 8 and verse 9 and verse 10 and in chapter 5 and verse 1. So the person that's speaking in verse 8 is a man that is engaged to this Shulamite woman. See, it is her shepherd lover. Somehow he shows up on the scene and he's able to talk to her. Okay? Now watch the difference between what the shepherd guy who really likes her and is engaged to her, watch the difference between his talk to her and Solomon's talk to her. What he does is talk about spices, because spices in the ancient world depicted the graces of one's soul, see, the warmth and the power of one's soul. Watch, verse 7, he begins to speak. Thou art all fair, my love, there is no spot in thee. Now what's that indicate? What would that mean? Somebody read that from another translation, verse 7, will you? Blemish, okay? Somebody else? Anybody else got another one? Different one? Look at chapter verse 2 of chapter 5. Now this is a Shulamite woman having a dream after this guy shows up. She says, I sleep, but my heart wakes. It is the voice of my beloved that knocks, saying, open to me, my sister, my love, my dove, my undefiled one. That word undefiled means that he looks upon her as, that's a title he has for her. She is perfectly clean in her soul, see? She is unspotted in her soul. So when he talks to her, he's thinking about her soul. Look at verse 8 of chapter 4. Come with me from Lebanon, my spouse, my engaged one, with me from Lebanon. Look from the top of Amana and from the top of Shinar and Hermon. What are those things? They're mountains. They're mountains, yeah. From the lion's dens, from the mountains of the leopards. Now look what he says in verse 9. Thou hast ravished my heart, my sister, my spouse. You have ravished my heart with one of your eyes. Now this is not Solomon talking here. No way could it be, see? This is the guy who's engaged to her. Okay? How much better is thy love than wine, and the smell of thy ointments than all the spices? Thy lips, O my spouse, drop as honeycomb, honey and milk are under thy tongue, and the smell of thy garments is like the smell of Lebanon. A garden enclosed is my sister, my spouse, a spring shut up, a fountain sealed. Thy plants are an orchard of pomegranates, with pleasant fruits and camphor and spikenard and saffron, calamus and cinnamon, with all the trees of frankincense, myrrh and alloys, with all the chief spices. A fountain of gardens, a well of living waters and streams of Lebanon. Now what do you picture when you see that? You know what I picture? I picture like those ads about Hawaii where you see the waterfall and all of these green shrubbery hanging over and flowers blooming. What's he describing?
Describing her.
What about her? What aspect of her is he describing? Yeah, he's describing her personality. He's describing how she impresses him. See? He is describing what fills his mind about her. He's describing her graces. In other words, okay? Okay. I think it's a term like of identity. It's a term of affection. I think it's a term of tenderness. Sort of he's expressing his attitude. These are titles that he has. He has several names for her. He calls her sister. He calls her spouse. He calls her beloved. He calls her unspotted one. He calls her love. Just little, they're terms of endearment that he has for her. Yeah. Okay. I think it's a term of sort of a delicate endearment. He is really touched by this girl. Now I want to tell you, that is what That sense of identity is what protected their relationship from immoral sexual acts, even though they were engaged. Now look, there's three things that we've got to cover. There's three questions that are key to young people that should be important to you, whether they are or not. One is, look, I've got sexual desires toward this girl, and she has sexual desires toward me. And after all, God made us, and God knows we have these sexual desires. Now, it's just dishonest. God made us like this. Now, why can't we just go ahead and have sexual relationships? That's one thing we have to deal with. Second thing we have to deal with is, what about if you're engaged and you believe that this person is your right man or right woman and you're engaged to them? And you're going to get married anyhow. Wouldn't it be okay if we just went ahead and had sex together? I mean, after all, we're going to get married anyhow. And we love each other. We're not going to have sex with other people. We're just going to have it together. Wouldn't God approve of that? That's a question we have to settle. Well, we have to talk about, okay? We can't talk about all these in one night. We're going to just take one tonight. What was the third one I wanted to talk about? I don't remember. It doesn't come to me right now. But there's another one that ought to be pertinent to you. This couple is engaged. They love each other. They're going to get married. They're just emotionally involved with one another, but they have had a clean relationship, see? So in verse 16, she speaks to him, and she says, "Awake, O north wind, and come, thou south wind. Blow upon my garden, that the spices may flow out. Let my beloved come into his garden and eat his pleasant fruits." Now that almost sounds like she's inviting him to have sexual relations, but she's not. He says in verse 5, "I am come into my garden, my sister, my spouse. I have gathered my myrrh with my spice. I have eaten my honeycomb with my honey. I have drunk my wine with my milk. Eat, O my friends, drink, yea, drink abundantly, O beloved." Now what he's saying is, this is not a reference to any type of a sexual act. He's just simply saying, I always enjoy the pleasure of your... She is saying, let the pleasure of my person flow out or blow upon this person who loves me. And he is saying, I always enjoy the presence of you and your company, your personality, what you emanate. These fill my mind like delicious food. I could not drink wine or milk with greater satisfaction than I drink of your graces. Okay? So let's get a principle, and then let's go to that other question, and we'll be done for tonight. Principle number 19. This is very important, and it's beautiful. The graces that flow between the souls of right man, right woman, before marriage, bind them together every bit as much as the sexual act after marriage. Now, I thought of that statement, and that, you know, that's a little strongly worded, because the sexual relationship between male and female is sort of a deeper bond. I don't want to say that you have all the fun and the joy out of soul relationship as you have out of sex. That's not true. I'm not trying to say that. I'm simply saying that there's a binding quality between the soul's graces, and that's what's being expressed here, see? So that in the second verse, there's going to be expression of the of the undefiled character of this woman that this guy loves. And that is why he calls her sister. So he's protecting that relationship. Okay? Okay. Now, how I want to take one more point. Let's see. I want to try to illustrate. I want to take one of those points that should be important to you relative to sex. Let's put it this way. Let's put the concept of protection, and we're not talking about divine viewpoint. We're talking about God's viewpoint. Protection relative to sex before marriage. I want to give you a protective thought. Okay, I didn't notice that line's on there. I'll have to move that. Okay. I'll be giving you maybe at least four or five of these protective thoughts relative to sex before marriage. Gee, is that focused? Is that my eyes? That's going to be focused a little bit. That isn't focused real good. You be sure and yell at me. Okay? Okay? Got the idea? Now I'm dealing with the question, what about sexual desires relative to protection, protection, divine viewpoint relative to sex before marriage? And we're talking about a protective thought now. What about sexual desires, emotions, didn't they come from God? Question mark. Well, see, the logic is, see, a person can make a religious excuse or a religious lay a religious groundwork in which to give himself justification to practice sexual relationship. We're dealing with the issue, why not then just go ahead? And have sex. Okay? Now, will you look at 1 Corinthians with me? I want you all to look at this passage. 1 Corinthians chapter 5. There were people that these were adults. These weren't teenagers. But often teenagers will think this way. They'll say, well, God made me with all these sexual desires, and there's nothing wrong with having sex. Well, there were adults that were using that same type of logic at Corinth. And I want you to see what the Bible has to say in 1 Corinthians chapter 5, I'm sorry, chapter 6, and verse 13. Okay, I'm just going to read verse 9 because it sort of introduces a thought, but I don't have a lot of time, so I'm not going to spend a lot of time on it. Know you not, verse 9 of chapter 6 of 1 Corinthians. It's in the New Testament. 1 Corinthians. Everybody have it? Mm-hmm. It's in the New Testament. 1 Corinthians. It's about halfway through the New Testament. Chapter 6 and verse 13. I'm going to read verse 9. Now listen to this. Know you not that unrighteousness shall not inherit the kingdom of God? Be not deceived, neither fornicators. What's a fornicator? Or a fornicator, the answer was, it's a person who has sex before he's married. That's one part of fornication. Fornicator is a very sexually loose person. It's a term that covers all kind of things. But it does include sexual intercourse that is outside the divine legitimacy, okay? Nor idolaters, nor adulterers, nor effeminate. Now, effeminate there meant sexual perversion. People who are perverts, lesbians, homosexuals, abusers of themselves with mankind, sodomites. Okay, got the idea? Okay. Now look at verse 13. Meats for the belly, and belly for the meats. But God shall destroy both it and them. Now the body is not for fornication, but for the Lord, and the Lord for the body. Does that make sense to you? Listen to that verse again, verse 13. Meats for the belly, and belly for the meats. But God shall destroy both it and them. Now the body is not for fornication, but for the Lord, and the Lord for the body. Does anybody know what that means? What does it mean when he says, meats for the belly, belly for the meats? Huh? Do you want to contribute something? What do you think it means? Really? Well, he's saying precisely the same thing that you're going to hear a lot of teenagers say. Teenagers are going to say, let me take the meats part. God made my belly with its appetites. Then he made meat so that I could satisfy my appetite. Meats were made for the belly, and belly for the meats. Take the same principle and apply it to the sexual appetite. God made me with my sexual appetites. Then he made the counterpart so that my sexual appetites could be satisfied. See? Sexual appetites and the counterparts. Meats for the belly, belly for the meats. See? It's that same logic that we have expressed in this question. But the verse goes on to say, now the body was not made for fornication, but the body was made for the Lord. Got the idea? So when they say, didn't these sexual desires come from God? The answer is to this, we'll give some points here. Yes, sexual desires did come from God. Point one. Point two. But sexual desires have been perverted by the sin nature. Okay? Maybe we should put the word healthy sexual desires did come from God. But sexual desires have been perverted by the sin nature. So that unhealthy sexual desires manifest themselves in fornication. So Paul says, verse 15, know you not that your bodies are members of Christ? Shall I then take the members of Christ and make them members of a harlot? God forbid. What? Know you not that he which is joined to an harlot is one body, for the two shall be one flesh? But he that is joined to the Lord is one spirit. So the idea is that though God gave us healthy sexual desires, they are only going to be maintained in the channels that he has directed them in. Or they are only going to find their proper fulfillment in the design that he has made them for. Got the idea? Look, fire is good in its proper context. It's good in the fireplace. Take the fire out of the fireplace and put it in the middle of the living room and the house burns down. Water is good in its proper context. Out in California, it got out of the proper context. Wash out a dam, wiped out 24 or 25 people. Water is good in your house and in the pipes and when you turn the faucet on. Get it out of its context and it destroys the house. See? And that is what illicit sex or sex does that God gave us if it isn't kept in the proper channels. So we have to say point three. Sex is good. We're talking now from divine viewpoint. Only when it is practiced. In the divine design. Take it out of those channels. What we mean by that is in God's channels. Take it out of those channels and it runs wild. And instead of producing something good and satisfying, it produces something destructive. And this is precisely what had happened to Solomon. A person who is loose sexually destroys his capacity to identify strongly with one person. Oh, I remembered now the other question I want to deal with. Somewhere along the line, it's this. Listen. Another argument that you have from young people is, well, we love each other, and we may even want to get married. We're engaged. But how do we know we'll be able to satisfy each other sexually after we get married if we don't try it before we get married? Okay? So we're going to deal with those other two remaining questions.
Shulamite woman has resisted Solomon. She's held him back. Her shepherd lover has showed up. And it's almost time for the rescue. Next week we'll take up with chapter 5. Are there any questions we could try to answer before we take some time for refreshments? Anybody have any questions? Okay, let's pray and then be
sure and help yourself to some of this refreshment because maybe that way then whoever brought it will bring some more next time. Shall we pray? Let's pray. We thank you, our Father, for this time and the enjoyment of being together and sharing these things in Christ's name. Amen.